At this time, Dr. Michael Keats.
Well, thank you, Ken, for inviting me. I'm going to be talking about intelligent design, unintelligent evolution, and the God hypothesis. And here you see a slight new rendition of Michelangelo's Sistine ceiling painting with God touching DNA and informing it. Okay. I'm going to introduce you to science and religion studies in general to set the stage. I not only teach at the college at Southwestern, which is at the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, which is a new undergraduate Great Books program, but I also teach in a master's program in science and religion at Biola University in Southern California. And so some of these talks have come from things I've taken from different classes, trying to put together a package that will deliver what Ken asked me to deliver. Science is just the attempt to explain nature, right? And religion is a faith response to the divine, or what is thought to be self-existent. If you read Roy Clouser's book, The Myth of Religious Neutrality, you will find a good argument for the if you look at the history of what divinity means, the core idea is self-existent, able to exist on its own, right, without depending upon anything else. Now, a scientific theory of origins could point to intelligent design, or it could point to unintelligent evolution. I mean, if you just came to science with an open mind and not knowing which way it might point, it could point one way, could point the other. So what you want to do is go to the evidence and see where the evidence leads. So what's intelligent design theory? It's the theory that certain features of the cosmos and of life are best explained by an intelligent cause, as opposed to an unintelligent or undirected process, such as natural selection, which was Darwin's proposal. Notice that intelligent design, or ID for short, is not a religious claim. J.P. Moreland, one of my colleagues at Biola University, who's a leading philosopher, Christian philosopher, defines faith, I think, in the clearest way I've yet seen. Yes, it's a response to the divine, but particularly faith is a trust or confidence. It's trusting what we have reason to believe is true. And he goes on to say that Christianity has been a friend of reason and knowledge. It's not an irrational leap into the dark. It's a step into the light. So how are science and theology related? And are they both knowledge? Well, philosophers define knowledge roughly as true belief held for good reasons. Okay, knowledge is true belief, and it's held for good reasons. So to believe that God exists is to have knowledge of his existence if the following are true. If he actually does exist, if you've got good reasons for that belief, and those good reasons could be a basic belief, that is, you have immediate experience of God, or as you read the scriptures, you have a sense that God is speaking to you through them. But it also can be justified by an argument. In fact, in my own way of looking at it, and many have said this as well, that there's actually double reasons, a double reason for believing in God. There's both the immediate experience of God, plus there's chains of reasoning that terminate or lead to the conclusion that God is. And that's often called an inferential belief. You infer it from evidence, in other words. So based on what I've said so far, what do you think, if science could lead to the probability that God exists as being high, if science could lead to God, what kind of belief would it be? A basic belief or an inferential belief?
Inferential.
Inferential, right. It would be a chain of inferences or rational steps based on evidence to a conclusion. That would be an inferential belief. Well, how are reason and faith related? Well, of course, Abraham is the paradigm example of faith, trust in God. But notice his faith was rooted in knowledge of God. So he had good reasons. Philosophers call this justification. It's not theological justification. This is philosophical justification. It means having good reasons for believing something. He had direct experience of God. God spoke with him, promised him things, and he saw these things being fulfilled. And Romans refers to how his faith was based in knowledge. And of course, Corinthians also talks about our faith is useless unless Christ really had been raised from the dead. So it's based on knowledge. It's not just a leap into the dark. It's a step into the light. So Moreland goes on to say in one of his recent books, Kingdom Triangle, that knowledge is the only appropriate ground for faith. The typical illustration is a chair. Do I believe it can hold me? Yeah. I know the structure of it. I've seen chairs before. Well, then I sit in it and I demonstrate my faith. Faith that it will hold me. Okay. So this is his book, Kingdom Triangle, which has some good, sort of good overview of science and faith, faith and reason and so on. So rejecting knowledge of God would, of course, produce a misdirected faith. We want to make sure we believe in the right God and have the right sort of knowledge, and that therefore our trust would be directed in the right sort of way. So knowledge of God comes from many sources, the Bible, that is God's revelation, experiencing God directly, and also what's called general revelation. Now I'm approaching it as theologians do. They often call this general revelation, that God speaks to us through the cosmos, if you will, and of course science would be the study of that, sort of the teasing out of that general revelation. Even secular scientists as renowned as Stephen Hawking, you can ask, does he have a faith in something? Well, he does. He thinks that... anyone want to take a guess as what Stephen Hawking thinks is divine? That is, divine being that upon which all else depends? Anyone want to take a guess?
Say something famous about zero.
He basically thinks that that upon which all else depends is number. He's a Pythagorean. He thinks that in fact his quest is to find the final theory, the theory of everything, and it will be a mathematical equation so persuasive, so powerful that it would be the actual cause of the universe. Now I think he's wrong. He's worshiping a false god, but nevertheless, here a brilliant scientist has a religious faith. It's not a traditional religious faith, but nevertheless, it is a belief in something as divine. That which is self-existent, okay? And of course, God revealed himself as the great I Am, right? Yahweh is self-existent. So everyone, I think, has some faith. It's the matter of which faith, okay? Now, intelligent design as a scientific research program is not based on religious beliefs. But, of course, it has religious implications. But, you know, all origin theories have religious implications. So intelligent design theory is not unique in having religious implications. If there's evidence for design, then of course that points to a designer. And many people would think that that's God, right? Yes, it has implications that are religious, but design theory itself is not religious. Again, there's the definition I read to you before. That's the basic definition of what design theory is. So it's not religion, and I'm going to demonstrate how it's not religious in itself, although it has implications that are religious. It's not based on any religious premises. I'm going to demonstrate that to you by taking a little tour through paleontology, the study of fossils. Okay. This is a curriculum that we're coming out with sometime in the near future. It's called the Cambrian Explosion. This is an event in Earth history that's not talked about a whole lot, but it's very important. A long time ago, the only animals alive were sponges, anemones, and flatworms. If you look at the standard geological way of dating different rock strata, different layers of rock, we look down and the earliest animals we find are these kinds of animals. Now these are obviously modern photographs, but the kind of fossils we find speak to these kinds of creatures being alive a long time ago. Well, what's the Cambrian Explosion? The Cambrian Explosion is when the highest divisions in the animal kingdom suddenly appeared on the Earth, most of them. And the highest divisions in the animal kingdom are called phyla, or one would be called a phylum, singular. So you have the animal kingdom, and then within the animal kingdom you have the different ways of being alive as an animal. And under that you have different subsets. So here I'll give you three examples of three phyla, three different, fundamentally different ways of being animals. You've got the cnidarian way of doing it, jellyfish being an example. You've got the arthropod way of being an animal. Here you have a crab as an example. And then you have the chordate way of being an animal. This is particularly a vertebrate chordate, one that has an actual backbone. And you can see they have different... a phylum is a distinctive set and arrangement of parts. Okay. Now, what do we mean by the Cambrian explosion? Well, it's the sudden appearance of these major animal body plans, these animal phyla, in the Cambrian period, which is in the earliest part of what's called the Paleozoic era. Before the Cambrian, you find very few fossils. They're there, but very few. But in the Cambrian, you have the sudden appearance of a whole bunch of life. What happened in the Cambrian explosion? Well, first of all, the first major feature of the Cambrian explosion is that you have the first appearance of most animal phyla, that is, the basic body plans of animal life. And here's some artist depictions of some of these and their phylum names. Here's one example. This is a brachiopod, and you can see the fossil image on the right and then an artist's reconstruction on the left. These are still alive today, but this is a very different way of being an animal than, say, this second slide. Looks like an ice cream cone with a lid on it, doesn't it? Here's a hyalitha, and you can see the fossil image of it there. And then the artist's reconstruction. Very different body plan than the previous slide, or than this slide. Here's a worm-like creature, but it comes in segments. You can see the little little bristles that it would use to move along the ocean bottom. These are all marine organisms that lived at the bottom of the ocean about 530 million years ago. Chordates, particularly with backbones like this fish. Prior to just 1999 when this was discovered, Darwinists would have laughed at you if you had said that vertebrates, full-blown vertebrates with backbones, existed back at this time. So here we have the first appearance of most animal body plans. These are just a few examples of the many that were found. The second major characteristic of the Cambrian explosion is not just most animal body plans appearing, but the suddenness of their appearing. So here I'm emphasizing a slightly different thing. It's the suddenness of their appearing that's quite striking, without evidence of precursors, of ancestors. So,
Just sure. Quick, is the date, do we have a time frame here?
Yeah. Here we have this is the today, the present day where we are standing today, 65 million years ago, 240.
Okay,
so this is 543 million years ago is when the Cambrian period started, and the Cambrian explosion occurred within this period here. Okay. Let's present life like a football field so we can all grasp this easily. Suppose we say that here we've got the origin of life. No, the origin of the universe. Excuse me, the origin of the Earth. We're talking Earth history. Here we have the origin of the Earth, when the Earth first came into existence, and it was if you assume the standard chronology, which I accept. I have no problem with that. I think it's consistent with Scripture. But anyway, that's another discussion. But if you accept the standard old Earth chronology, the Earth originated 4.6 billion years ago. And then on the 17-yard line was when life first appeared. And it's interesting, as soon as the Earth cooled enough for life to be possible to occur on Earth, boom, almost immediately it's there, which is a problem for Darwinists, because to get life from non-life, that's the largest leap of all, going from non-life to life. And as soon as the Earth was cool enough, boom, you've got life. Very shortly thereafter. And if the Cambrian explosion didn't occur until way down on the other side of the football field. Now, of course, the 0-yard line over here would represent where we are in time. This occurred on about the 12-yard line on the opposite side of the field. That's when the Cambrian explosion occurred. Within about a 5 million year window of time, 530 to 525 million years ago. That's a very actually a short frame of time. That's 8 inches on the football field. 8 inches is 0.2% of Earth history. 0.2% of Earth history. You have the majority of animal body plans appearing suddenly on the Earth, and that's a problem for Darwinists. A huge problem. So the suddenness of the appearance is a problem. There's also the third characteristic. It's the top-down pattern of appearance. Now, this is going to take a little explaining. What do I mean by top-down pattern of appearance? Well, remember I was showing you this earlier, that within the animal kingdom, you have different phyla, right? You've got the jellyfish type way of being an animal. You've got the crab way of being an animal. Those are different phyla. Remember that? And then you have, within each file, you have different classes and orders and so on. These are called the higher taxa, the big categories of life. And then you have what are called the lower taxa, the more specific categories. In fact, the most specific of categories is species, from which we get the word specific, right? That's the most specific. Of course, you also have varieties within each species, but these are the lower taxa. And what we have, a really curious feature of the Cambrian explosion, is that is called this top-down pattern of appearance. That is disparity before diversity. Disparity, the major differences, appear suddenly in the fossil record, and only later do the minor differences show up. This is the exact opposite of what you'd expect from a Darwinian perspective, which I'll explain in a moment. But just first, look at the data itself before we try to compare design theory with Darwinism. Just look at the data, the raw data by itself. Even Darwinist paleontologists admit this is what the fossil record shows. Disparity, that is the major differences, occurs before the multiplication of small differences, diversity, later on. That's called top-down pattern of appearance. Okay, so we've got three main features of the Cambrian explosion. We've got most animal body plans, that is most animal phyla, appearing suddenly on the Earth. Appearing on the Earth, that's the first feature. The second feature is the suddenness of that appearance, particularly without evidence of where they came from. And third, this top-down pattern of appearance. There's a few other features, but I'm just going to make it short. These are the three main features. Now what we want to do is look at answers. What explains this data? What are the competing theories, possible answers to explain this data? And of course, Darwin's theory has some possible answers. But first, let's look at the predictions that Darwin made and Darwinists continue to make based on his theory today. First, you have the idea... First, I want to introduce his theory. Darwin's theory can be boiled down to two basic claims. First, the claim that life, the pattern of appearance of life on Earth is like a tree. You start off at the bottom with the origin of life. That would be like where the bottom of the trunk of the tree, if you will, where it meets the ground. That would represent the origin of life. And then as you go up the tree, this is a 19th century illustration, by the way, from a German Darwinist. As you go up the tree, then you have branches coming off, right? So a branching pattern of appearance. That's the first basic claim of Darwinism. The second basic claim is the claim that that natural selection has the creative power to produce the tree of life. So one claim is the pattern of appearance of life. The second claim of the theory is the causal process that drove that forward, that made it happen. Okay, so two aspects to his theory here. Now, how, if this were true, what would you expect to see in the fossil record? That's what we're going to look at this moment. That is, what predictions would do Darwinists make? Well, there's a couple. First prediction is you would expect to see a gradual increase of biological complexity, of more and more complex creatures, and the existence of transitional forms leading to these major body plans of animals called phyla. That would be the first prediction. In other words, when we're going to be talking just about animals today. We're going to forget plants and other creatures that are neither plant nor animal. But when the first animals appeared on the Earth, according to Darwinism, what you would expect to find is that they would all be basically the same, have a very similar structure. They would belong to one common phylum, one kind of body structure. That is, they would be very similar. And then over time, as you take a slice through here, this is later. Each one is a later slice of time until we get to the present. Midway through the history of life, you'd expect to have a number of animal phyla of different basic body plans. And then today, of course, we expect to have the many that we have, the different phyla, the different body plans of animals that we have existing today. That's the prediction. Now, compare that prediction with the actual fossil data. What we find is in the Precambrian period, we have three animal body plans that appear. Remember I showed you modern marine photographs of sponges and flatworms and so on. There's three basic body plans that appear in the Precambrium, and that's a they also appeared suddenly without evidence of ancestors. One of them, then you have a whole bunch of animal phyla that first appeared just into the Paleozoic era, particularly in the Cambrian part of the Paleozoic era, and that's known as the Cambrian explosion. And then you have about six other animal phyla that make their appearances at later times in Earth history, this being the present at the top. So here we are at the present, here we are deep down in deep time. Now,
do we find in the Paleozoic, do we find fossils or mutations that didn't survive and move on that were either less complete? Is there traces of species that didn't live on that we find?
Yes, we do. That's what the lines represent, the terminae. Okay. That would be extinction.
But and not too many, huh?
No. I mean, as far as there aren't that many animal phyla that are extinct. There's millions of species that have gone extinct. But animal phyla are the big categories, remember?
Right.
Which includes lots of species.
Sure.
So the big, there aren't that many of the big categories of life that are totally non-represented today.
Right.
But there's millions of species, of course, that have gone extinct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you show that one of the three in the Precambrian era didn't survive the Precambrian era?
Well, because there's some... The flatworm, I represent it by a modern photograph, but they don't actually have fossils of the creature. All they have is fossils of the tracks that it made. So some think that it was a flatworm, others thinking it might be something else that wasn't a flatworm that might have gone extinct. So that's why there's a question mark there. Okay, but look at the big overall pattern. This is the Darwinian expectation. You start off with one basic animal phylum, and then later you get maybe 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on, right? As you cut slice through time until you get the large number today. This is what we actually find, and the contrast is very striking, isn't it, between theoretical expectation and the actual fossil data. And Darwinists admit, and this is Richard Dawkins, who, if you've seen the movie Expelled, which played in theaters, was caught in some candid moments, which he later regretted, he once said, it's as though they, the animal phyla, were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Now, of course, he's a Darwinist. He just chalks this up as an unsolved problem. Okay, but he's honest that it's a problem. The second prediction of Darwinists is that there should be a bottom-up pattern of appearance. That is, diversity, small differences among creatures, should appear before the multiplication of the big differences, disparity, at the phyla level. Now, I'll illustrate this in the following way. When the first animal appeared on the Earth, you would expect it to be one species, of course. And then a little bit later, a few, if Darwinism is true, you'd expect a cluster of closely related species that would, if a biologist were alive at the time, observing them, would say, these belong to one genus, right? And then, as time goes on, according to Darwinism, you'd expect small differences to become slightly bigger differences until, if a biologist were alive at the time, they would say, well, we've got, looks like, three natural clusters here of species. We'll call this genus 1, genus 2, genus 3, and, of course, give them nice Latin Greek names. And then, eventually, you would say, well, over time, it looks like we've got two families now, that this cluster of genera and this cluster of genera are enough separated here. They've become their anatomy and their internal organs have become different enough that we're going to classify them as different families. You get the picture here? So this is just kind of a general sort of simulation of what Darwinism would look like if it were true, if it actually happened. Now, notice that we even here, all of this is still pretty small-scale change we're talking about. In fact, even young Earth creationists generally believe that there is a certain amount of microevolution, small-scale evolution, that does take place, even up to the level of families. Okay, but that's for another conversation. But what Darwinists have a problem with is how would you get from that to an entirely different phylum? Now, notice that I put a dot, dot, dot here, meaning that as you go up on the graph, that represents time, right? Time ticking away. Time going, 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 going. Horizontal on the graph represents differences in animal structure, right? Differences in anatomy. Okay. Now, if you go from one phylum to a wholly different phylum, I'd have to go not only off the screen, but several rooms down in the hotel to represent how different that animal would be if you were graphing its anatomy. So Darwinists would say that this little tree would grow and grow and grow until it gets wide enough that it would fill several rooms in the hotel and finally get to a different phylum, way over there, okay? From one phylum to another phylum. Okay, that would be disparity, big change. Now, a newer version of Darwinism called punctuated equilibrium tries to solve the problem of the gaps in the fossil record by saying that evolution occurs in rapid bursts, so rapid that they don't get fossilized. Now, this does, if there were a credible mechanism for it, which they're still searching for, but if there were a credible mechanism for it, it would solve the problem of the small gaps in the fossil record, but it wouldn't even touch the problem of the big gaps in the fossil record that separate one phylum from another phylum. That's disparity, the major differences that appear suddenly in the fossil record. So even punctuated equilibrium, which is often offered as sort of a solution to the gaps in the fossil record, only solves the small gaps, not the huge gaping gaps. Okay. And here's a quote from a multi-authored journal article in a professional journal called Evolution by some mainstream Darwinian paleontologists, fossil experts, who are basically saying, yeah, there's a problem here. There's this top-down pattern of appearance. We should see a bottom-up pattern, but we see a top-down pattern, and this is a problem. All right, so Darwinists have an unsolved problem here. How do design theorists look at the data and interpret it? I'm going to focus on just two of the three features, the top-down pattern of appearance and the sudden appearance without ancestry. First, the top-down pattern of appearance. Since we just covered it, the data, and then notice how Darwinists expect it to be bottom-up, right? Because, right, these slides here, the whole point was Darwinists expect a bottom-up pattern of appearance. Small differences appearing first, and then much later in time, the big differences appearing. I just illustrated that, right? That's called bottom-up pattern of appearance. Design theorists looking at this say, you know, top-down pattern of appearance is what we would expect, and I'll explain why. Top-down, what we actually see in the fossil record is the major differences that separate, let's say, trilobites from fish with backbones, vertebrate fish. These are major differences. I mean, trilobites don't even have a backbone. And they have their skeletons, if so to speak, on the outside, an exoskeleton. So these are very different ways of being alive as an animal. That's disparity, big difference, right? That appears suddenly in the fossil record. And then only later do you get the multiplication of small differences. Now, if you go scuba diving today in the ocean, I guess this is not appropriate for Texans here, unless you're in South Texas, but if you go scuba diving, you'll find a bewildering array of vertebrate fish, right? But if you were to be scuba diving in the Cambrian oceans 530 million years ago, there would have been only a few ways of being alive as fish. Very, very small number of species, but yet nevertheless they appeared suddenly. Now, here's the interesting part. If you look at the history of technology, that is human technology over the span of human life on Earth, and if you look at, for example, the history of transportation, now I'm going to use these terms a little loosely here, we're going to talk about the kingdom called transportation, okay? Not the animal kingdom, but the transportation kingdom. Okay, and we're going to look at two major phyla, transportation phyla, if you will, airplanes and cars. Okay, now when airplanes and cars first appeared, of course, cars appeared before airplanes, but when they first appeared, there were very few ways of being an airplane, very few ways of being a car. Right? You go to a car lot when cars were first invented, you know, either model A or B or whatever. Right? Very few choices. Right? Now you go to a car lot, and there's a bewildering array of choices, right? Of very small, fine differences from one car to the next. That's diversity. So in the history of technology, what do you have? The sudden appearance of cars with very few minor differences, right? And then later on in the history of technology, in the cars, you've got the multiplication of the small differences. So you've got a top-down pattern of appearance in the history of technology. Interesting. What kind of causal process is at work in the history of technology? Is it chance? Is it natural law? Or is it intelligent design? everyone acknowledges it's intelligent design, right? So in the case of a historical process where we know the causal mechanism, in this case, human intelligence is the causal mechanism, we know the causal story, and we see what we see is a top-down pattern of appearance. Now, in the case of the appearance of animals in the fossil record, of course, as good scientists, you'd want to start the investigation with saying, well, I'm not sure what the causal process it was. It could have been chance and natural law, or it could have been intelligent. I'm not sure. Well, what is the pattern of appearance? It's a top-down pattern of appearance. And the only kind of causal process that we know of that actually does that is intelligent agency. Now, this is not an argument from ignorance. This is an argument based on the ordinary cause and effect structure of the world that we all know of. Okay? So it's not an argument from ignorance. It's an argument from knowledge, what we know about the world. I emphasize that because many critics of design theory say, oh, you guys, you're just lazy. You see a problem that can't be solved by science, and then you just say, God did it. And that's a science stopper. No, we actually have evidence. It's an argument based on knowledge, not on ignorance. It's based on what we know about the cause and effect structure of the world. All right, let's look at the second major feature of the Cambrian explosion, that is the suddenness of the appearance without evidence of ancestry. How do design theorists look at that? Well, we know that the mind can leap to new designs. Now, sometimes there are material prototypes. Back a few years ago, when we were celebrating the centennial of the first flight, I went to an exhibit in Wichita, Kansas. Maybe you've seen it. And we actually got to fly the airplane simulator and so on. And they talked about, there were some material prototypes, as you know, from the history of aviation that came before the first successful flight. But there need not be, and there's other cases where there's not. For example, in going from old LP records to the CD, there wasn't a series of material intermediates. There was a leap of the human mind. Now, I must admit, I took my son, who's now at the mall, we were garage sailing once, which used to be a pastime of ours, and he had never seen one of these before. And when he saw it, he said, hey, Dad, a big CD. No, it's not. Actually, I said, Josiah, there's actually physically little grooves in that plastic disc, and there's a little needle that will ride in those grooves, and it will interpret those grooves as music. That's totally different than a digitally embedded data in that plastic disc over there. I mean, there's not a series of physical intermediates. The mind can leap to a whole new design. That's one of the wonders about being human. Is the ingenuity of the human mind can leap to a whole new design. Sometimes there are physical intermediates, sometimes there are not. Okay? The mind is an amazing thing. We're made in God's image. And again, I'm speaking as a Christian, looking, by the way, a traditional historic Trinitarian Christian, but thank you for inviting me anyway. As a Christian, I look at this scientific data and I say, this is a marvelous illustration, or the history of technology, and I say this is a marvelous illustration of how we're made in God's image, right? Amazing what the mind can do. Okay, so we've got several multiple competing hypotheses, possible interpretations. Here we have the Cambrian explosion, the actual data, the fossil data, which I summarized for you. And then here's three competing interpretations. We've got traditional Darwinism, actually it's called Neo-Darwinism, new since the 1930s, which is kind of old by now, but it's still called Neo-Darwinism. You've got even a newer version of Darwinism called punctuated equilibrium, invented in the 1970s. So you've got the 1930s version of Darwinism, the 1970s version, which is still kind of the latest new Darwinism, and you've got intelligent design theory, each trying to explain what's happening in the Cambrian explosion. And I think to infer the best explanation, if you look at the data with an open mind, I think it clearly points to design. Again, the top-down pattern of appearance and the sudden appearance without ancestors, those are the hallmarks of the way intelligent agency works in the world, not the way chance and natural processes work. So I think there's a clear, strong inference to design based on what we know. It's not a leap, oh, well, we don't know how to solve this scientifically, so we just say God did it. No, it's a scientific inference to intelligent agency. Now, notice that science is not capable by itself of identifying who the designer is. It's only capable of telling you there is some sort of intelligent agency at work here. Okay? It requires additional fields of knowledge, particularly theology and philosophy, other fields, to address the problem of who is the designer. Science can give us some hints, and I'll explain that a little bit later. But it's a good instrument. It's a good tool for doing certain things, but it can only go so far. Okay. All right. Well, what's taught in the classrooms? By the way, I have a plan here. Give you an overview. We're in about 10 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. We're going to take. I'm going to stop for some questions. We're going to take a little break, and then I've got a movie clip I'm going to show you. And so I have actually two distinct presentations here. Which is good, because it's good to actually get up and stand up for a few minutes. So we'll have a break in about 5-10 minutes, but let me finish this talk first. What's being taught in classrooms today? Well, textbooks, science textbooks, present only half the scientific picture. They'll mention the Cambrian explosion, but they leave out the significance of it. They leave out, for example, the nagging fact, the embarrassing fact for Darwinists, that most major groups of animals appeared, not all of them, but most of them appeared suddenly in the Cambrian period in the Cambrian explosion without ancestors, without evidence of ancestors. They also leave out other challenges to Darwin's theory, particularly challenges to the alleged creative power of natural selection. Natural selection is real, it works. But what we're finding is it only produces very, very limited amounts of change. It doesn't present the vast amount of change that Darwin thought it might. So that's this sort of thing. These embarrassing facts are left out of textbooks. And by the way, I did testify before the State Board of Education down in Austin back in January. This has been in the news if you're a Texan. Even if you're not, you may have heard about it. Okay, Darwin's theory... design theory, in contrast, as I said, is not an argument from ignorance. It's based on what we know about the little biological machines, for example, that make up even the simplest living cells. For example, the bacterial flagellum, which is sort of the poster child of the design movement. It's well known that this little outboard motor has all the people like Scott Minnick, have a senior research professor at the University of Idaho, has spent the better part of his career studying this little flagellar outboard motor that typically is outfitted on the end of a bacterium cell, a single-celled creature, that makes it enables it to move through its aqueous environment, through its watery environment. And you can see it has, it's literally a motor. This is not just a metaphor. It is a motor. It's a rotary motor. And it has the parts of a rotary motor. That if you remove... There's a list of essential parts, and if you remove any one of those essential parts, the whole thing doesn't work. And the problem for Darwinists is, how would you get this in a piece-by-piece mutation and selection process of accident after accident, where you would get the pieces all together? This really resists explanation from a Darwinian point of view. So now many critique design, say, hey, it's not science, it's just you know, it's just religion repackaged in a way that looks like science, because you can't see the designer. You can't observe the designer. Well, when's the last time you saw an electron? Or when's the last time you saw the Big Bang happen, the origin of the universe? Well, these are things you can't see, but nevertheless, there's evidence that electrons exist. There's evidence that the Big Bang occurred, the creation moment of the universe, if you will. There's evidence that these things happen. That is, the universe has not existed forever. That's an outmoded idea. The majority viewpoint now is the universe had a beginning. Okay, so you can't see these things directly, but you can see traces of them indirectly. And the same thing with the designer. We can't see the creator directly, or the designer, but we can see evidence of the designer's work. Okay, just as we can conclude design from observable effects that are still around today. And furthermore, Darwinists have a lot of unobservable things. for example, transitional organisms that aren't seen. Remember, we just did the fossil record. Well, one very small story of the fossil record. And you have transitional forms that must have existed if Darwinism is true, but we don't see them, right? That's a big problem. Or the process of natural selection. It's alleged to be a creative process that drives massive change. And yet, the only kind of change that we've actually observed natural selection do is very trivial change, very small-scale change that even the most conservative young earth creationists believe in. So, again, all origin theories have religious implications. Even Darwinism. Ken Miller's one of the most popular textbooks, high school biology textbooks by Ken Miller, at one time, I'm not sure if he still says this, said that evolution works without either plan or purpose. That obviously has religious implications, right? It's a scientific claim that has religious implications. Many think that ID, intelligent design, points to God. Obviously, that's a religious implication, but design theory itself is not a religious claim. It's basically just inferring some kind of intelligent agency. In fact, ancient Greeks, some famous ancient Greeks, were design theorists. Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, for example, three of the greatest philosophers of all time, were design theorists. They were pagan design theorists. They thought that design, the designing intelligence, was somehow inherent within the universe itself, sort of a pantheistic sort of view. One need not say that design theory is just a cheap, fundamentalist Christian invention. It's not. It's been around for a very long time. Okay? So, now, let me tie this together. What are the religious implications of paleontology, the study of fossils? Well, I think what we see, remember there was the Precambrian, the sudden appearance of the Precambrian organisms, three basic kinds of animals, and the sudden appearance of most animal body plans, and then later, sudden appearance of a few other animal body plans. I think what we have evidence here is evidence, if you wanted to be a little more specific about what kind of religious claims are more, are better implied or more likely implied by this data, I think it would definitely count against deism. Deism is the view that God just, you know, created everything and then walked away and then didn't do anything after that. I think we've got clear evidence of the intelligent agency working at distinct times, at multiple points in Earth history, not just once, but multiple times. That would definitely count against deism, wouldn't it? Well, what about intelligent design in astronomy and cosmology? I've covered it in the life sciences, Earth and life sciences. What about in the physical sciences, looking at the cosmos as a whole? Well, we'll do that after our break. But first, do you have any questions about the general idea of design theory and how intelligent design is a competitor to unintelligent evolution? By that I mean evolutionists claim that it's an unguided process. It's not guided by intelligence. That's the claim of Darwinism. And then I've showed you the fossil evidence, and I've compared both theories to the fossil evidence and shown you how I think one is more clearly supported, the other isn't. But do you have any questions about that before we take a break and then go into my second talk about the physical sciences?
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Do you consider things like disease-causing bacteria to be a product of intelligent design?
Yeah, I think there's a very interesting discussion about what's known as theodicy. It's this discussion of how do you account for, design that, for example, Darwin was really upset with discovering that certain creatures feed on little caterpillars while they're still alive and eat them alive, or the cat playing with the mouse before it kills it, and so on. These famous examples of natural evil, if you will, or natural design that, or however you might interpret, but or disease-causing organisms, bacteria, viruses. If you look at the structure of viruses, they look like high-tech little, you know, creatures they're not technically alive. They hijack the machinery of life to replicate themselves. It's kind of like a computer virus. It's not alive, but it hijacks the software. Anyway, so I think what you have there is to go into theodicy, of course, is going beyond the bounds of just science. Scientists can just say, whether you like the design or not, whether you call it good design or bad design is design, and it implicates a designer. Now, why would a designer make something like that? That's a question that gets into philosophy and theology, doesn't it? Beyond the realm of science. And I think there are good... now I'm switching... I'm putting on my philosophy and theology hat. And my, by the way, my field is... My PhD is not in science. My PhD is in the history of science. And my expertise is in the history and philosophy of science and theology. Okay? So I am comfortable in these other areas. But I want you to... I'm giving you notice, I'm changing disciplinary talk. I'm now going from science to philosophy and theology. And to answer your question, I would say that I think, in fact, Bill Dembski, my colleague at Southwestern, one of the architects of the methodological structure of design theory, has just come out with a book called The End of Christianity. Now, he's also a traditional Trinitarian Christian like myself, so don't take too much of his title. But his book, I think, is the best attempt thus far to deal with theodicy, both from science and philosophy and theology. The only thing I don't like about Bill Dembski is he has two PhDs and I only have one. Okay. Other than that, he's a very nice guy. His book called The End of Christianity, I think, is one of the best attempts to pull together both science and theology and to try to address the theodicy question, which is the million-dollar question in science and theology, in science and religion studies. Theodicy is the most interesting question of all, of how you integrate science and theology. In short, without telling you what the whole book is about, it goes like this. I think that that when Adam and Eve were created in the garden, they were in a little oasis of no pain and suffering, but in the world outside the garden, millions of years back, there had been millions of years of animal death, okay? And when Adam and Eve were created, first Adam and then Eve, there was no pain, they had no experience, first-hand experience of suffering or pain and death. There was no, God supernaturally created sort of an oasis of no suffering and pain in the Garden of Eden. And when they sinned, particularly Adam as the head, when they sinned, they notice what happened. What was their judgment? They had to leave what? The garden. And there was a sentry, an angel posted to not let them back in again. And I think they were sent out to a world that was already prepared for their fallen condition. Now, why was the world in that condition full of animal suffering and death that had already been there millions of years? I think the reason for that was the sin of Adam, and secondarily the sin of Eve, was the sin of Adam and Eve.
Okay? In advance?
Right, and it serves as, and notice that just as the cross of Christ, Abraham was saved by faith, looking forward to Christ. There is no other name under heaven whereby we are saved, the Bible says. So I think just as the cross of Christ was the reason for all salvation, both forward in time and backward in time, I think Adam and Eve's sin in the garden is the reason for all suffering and pain, both forward in time and backward in time. But that's the age-old theodicy question, and Bill Dembski's book gets into both the science and the theology of that, and I've given you a really, really brief kind of appetizer, if you will, for his book. And that would include bacteria, animal predation, all that had been around for a long, long, long time before Adam and Eve ever showed up. Yes?
Might be a little simpler, I hope.
Okay, good. Hope so. That was the biggest question that could be asked of the whole day. Yeah. And what is your name?
John.
Good idea. Good question. Okay.
The scientist that was working on the pump?
Yeah, the little, actually it's the outboard motor.
Right.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
His name's Scott Minnick. Scott Minnick. And if you want...
We're trying to do in this seminar, in our positions on the pre-existence of Christ, sometimes we try to find one thing that will answer the question, which sounds like Scott, if, like you said, I've heard about him or about this theory that if any one of those things in his system is missing, then the whole thing collapses.
Right.
Someone was saying that about a cell, that if one of the things that make up the cell itself is missing at any time, then the cell dies.
Yeah.
There's no way for it to mutate or to move on, right?
What we've done is, and a more famous guy who's worked on the flagellar motor is a guy named Mike Behe, you've heard maybe his name. He compares it to a mousetrap. It's like if you have all the parts of the mousetrap together, it'll work. But if you remove one piece, it's not a slightly less worse mousetrap. It just doesn't work. Unless you have a very inept mouse that somehow gets caught in it. You know. But yeah, it doesn't work as a mousetrap. Yeah. So there's tons of books. If you go to discovery.org, this Discovery Institute, which I also work with, discovery.org is one place you can go to, and there's links from there to all kinds of websites. You can download free articles. You can order the video I'm going to show you a clip of after the break, called The Case for a Creator, Lee Strobel's work. And Lee Strobel interviews a lot of our scientists at Discovery Institute, but he's actually not with Discovery Institute. And we collaborate with all kinds of scientists. There, some of which are agnostics, but they still see the design, you know, theory as the way to go. Darwinism is on its way out, they think. So there's a lot of exciting work here.
So to simplify, Scott and the other, would you say Mike?
Mike Behe.
But if that can be irrefutable in the sense of science, mm-hmm. which it seems like it can be, because if you take away any one of those parts and
letting
orgasm, it ceases to exist. So the whole theory could be decided based on one theory like that or one experiment, right? Is that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important in science that anytime you have theories as big as design and Darwinism, these are. I mean, there's also a lot of small-scale theories like, you know, acid-base chemistry and, you know, a lot of other very specific. These are very sort of large, big umbrella theories. And to fairly judge them, you need to look at multiple classes of evidence, not just one line of evidence. So you look at paleontology, you look at the experiments with bacteria, mutating them on purpose, which we've done for 150 years, and still end up with bacteria after artificially mutating them, which, because bacteria have such a short lifespan, it actually simulates millions of years by massively mutating these things. And all we get is just more bacteria. Okay, some are antibiotic resistance, but that's actually a whole other story. It's horizontal change, not vertical change. It's just evading artificial antibiotics. Once you place them back in the wild, they're actually less fit, but that's a whole other story. Another hint.
A couple weeks ago, I was listening to a talk show late at night, and there was a physicist on there named Peter Ward from Seattle.
Yes.
And he was talking about intelligent design, because he was asked about it by the host, Mark Bell. And he said he wasn't commenting on whether intelligent design was true or not, but he said it wasn't science because it's not falsifiable.
Yeah. Okay. The term falsifiable was particularly championed by a philosopher of science named Karl Popper, a British guy. And basically, it's this: many scientists today still think that, and I agree, that a good characteristic of a theory, a scientific theory, is one that, if it were false, there would be a way to show that it's false. That's what falsifiable means: able to show it's false if it were false. Now, you can concoct theories. A lot of conspiracy theories are like this, where there's no way to falsify it. Well, every time someone comes up with some counter instance that doesn't fit the theory, you just change the theory a little bit. Oh, well, and make the theory more and more complicated, right? So a good theory is one that makes risky predictions, such that if the predictions were shown to be false, then that would maybe not completely falsify the whole theory, but at least make you seriously doubt that theory. Now, small-scale theories are much easier to construct as falsifiable, like I could say acid-base chemistry or very, very, very specific theories are a lot easier to form as a falsifiable unit. But broad umbrella theories, as big, as giant as design theory and Darwinism itself, are a lot more tricky to make falsifiable. And I'm saying this to be fair to both sides, both the Darwinists and the design theorists. But we do have, for example, if you watch the movie Privileged Planet, or the book by the same title, The Privileged Planet, which you can pick up from our website, discovery.org, one of our very talented astrobiologists, Guillermo Gonzalez, who recently lost his job at Iowa State University because of his design theory, but now he's at a Christian college, he and Jay Richards published this book, Privileged Planet Hypothesis, The Privileged Planet, where they make a number of daring predictions of what we will find in the next 10, 20, 30 years in physical sciences as to the likelihood of finding life in other places. And it's a very complicated thesis. But they have come up with a lot of predictions that are, as individual predictions, falsifiable. And that's a part of design theory. So I think it's patently false to claim that design theory or parts of design theory are not falsifiable. But to be fair to both sides, it's hard to completely falsify one huge theory by just one fact that doesn't fit it. And both theories have made adjustments to their theories to accommodate new facts. And that's, at some point, you kind of have to draw the line and say, well, is there a track record of just, well, kind of like a teenager, why were you home late? It keeps coming up with more and more excuses, right? And eventually you find out they're lying, right? That's a sign of a bad theory. That is a massive lie, right?
Are you telling us he's not with you and he's not at the mall?
Well, we'll see what his story is when he comes back at 5. But anyway, you have to look at kind of the track record of a theory. That's one of my expertises as a historian of science. Not just what they're claiming today, but what scientists have claimed over time, and has their theory really shown promise of advancing itself, not just making excuses like a teenager lying. Okay, so, and I think often Darwinists have changed their mind several times about their theory in a way that kind of sounds like the teenager who's kind of gotten caught. Okay, yes.
So if an objection to intelligent design is it's not science because it's not falsifiable, is evolution science because it is falsifiable?
Well, I think in some ways any theory that's as comprehensive as design and Darwinism, it's hard to make either of those truly falsifiable. I mean, philosophers of science, by the way, Peter Ward is not a philosopher of science. And philosophers of science have actually kind of criticized overusing this falsifiable criterion for what counts as science, and they say that's...
But I thought it was interesting, though, he did say, for all I know, he says, I'm not saying it's incorrect, so maybe it is.
Yeah, well, I think that to the degree that I think that design theory can be made falsifiable to a degree, and I think to a higher degree than Darwinism can be. So I think Darwinism is less falsifiable, that is less open to harm's way, if you will, and more just sort of a indoctrination into a way of thinking, a paradigm, a worldview that lacks the evidence and is right now, you can tell they're really desperate because they're trying to shut down any kind of discussion, any kind of fair-minded, open public discussion. It shows you how desperate they are. They're trying to control by power moves rather than through argumentation. I think that's just wrong. And it's a sign that it's this dying paradigm, I think. Yes?
I watched the television show where they did this Pennsylvania school case.
Yes, Dover.
Dover. And there they did seem to show, if I remember correctly, that the helicopter that he was showing, that there is another, that some of those parts are missing in another organism and functioning properly, number one. That's what they were showing on there.
You're talking about the little outboard motor, yeah, the flagellum. Right, the flagellum, yeah.
The motor.
It almost looks like a helicopter. It's a big floppy thing that goes like this, flops around and propels the bacteria through the water.
And also, yeah. I guess I find it troubling why some scientists like Francis Collins and Alistair McGrath,
right,
why they don't like intelligent design.
The best website to go to get this interesting dialogue going between theistic evolutionists, many of whom are Christians,
yes,
and design theorists, many of whom are Christians, but again, there's pagan design theorists too, historically and today, both, okay? The best website to go to that's just been unveiled like a couple weeks ago is faithandevolution.org. All run together, faithandevolution, A-N-D, faithandevolution.org. It's one of the projects at Discovery Institute. We got a grant to put this up, and we have links to and articles about everything that the theistic evolutionists are saying. We're saying, and I recognize that's a possibility if God could have done it that way. Okay, but I still say, where does the evidence really lead? I think the scientific evidence points decisively away from theistic evolution. But I have dear brothers and sisters in Christ who are theistic evolutionists and good friends of mine, And you've mentioned some of the bigger names. Francis Collin is the biggest name. And they have their websites, and we've got links to their websites. So you can go back and forth between their websites and our website and compare and look at the evidence yourself. It's a fascinating discussion where it involves, again, both science and theology. Yeah. Okay, one last question, and then we'll take our break, and then I'll make sure the movie works. Yes, Ken.
Just to say, I do, in our booklet here, mention faithandevolution.org.
Oh, you do? Okay. Good for you.
Some websites, and I've been to the site, and it's truly good. And a few other books on intelligent design. There are many more, but you go to any of these websites that list below this list here,
right,
and you can get some good information. Most of it's free.
This guy's on the ball. I mean, the website's only been up a couple of weeks. He already knows about it. Okay. All right, let's take, how about a 5-minute break? I'll make sure the movie works, and then we'll start off right away with a great movie, okay? A clip of it.